Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is David Baldacci. The number one New York Times bestseller has written gazillions of books, and he's out with his brand new Atlee Pine thriller. It is called A Minute to Midnight. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. David, I loved this book because it got us out of the FBI realm, but introduce Atlee Pine and how she goes from an FBI agent out in the wilderness of the Grand Canyon and the Supermax prison all the way to Georgia.
Yeah, she's a special agent with the FBI assigned to the Grand Canyon area, but the beginning of the book opens with her being at the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. There's a serial killer there who she thinks might have abducted her twin sister, Mercy, when they were both 6 years old and living in Andersville, in Georgia, obviously 30 years ago. She gets no resolution from this guy at all. He's just sort of playing her along. And when she leaves, she gets an Amber Alert while she's still in Colorado. This pedophile has snatched a young girl from a soccer match. Fortunately, she sees the guy, trails him, traps him in a box canyon. They have a confrontation. She's able to rescue the little girl, but then 30 years of fury and frustration and anger and seeing the serial killer in this guy's face just bursts, and she ends up almost beating this guy to death, which obviously is not looked upon, you know, well by the FBI, and she's given an ultimatum by her boss. Figure this out. Get your head straight. Find out what happened to your sister, or you're not going to have a future with the Bureau. And because of that, she has to jump on a plane with her assistant, Carol Blom, fly across the country to Georgia, where all of this happened 30 years ago, and really immerse herself back in her past in order to figure out if she has a future.
This book, we learned a lot more about Atlee and her backstory and what makes her go in life, but Carol Blom, her assistant, she's kind of a motherly type. What is it that inspires her to be so loyal to Atlee Pine?
Yeah, I think there are a number of things. One, she's a mother of six, so she has really, you know, she's done her duty in that regard and probably seen every situation possible. And she's estranged from some of her own kids, and that may be why she looks so fondly upon Atlee, maybe like she's another daughter of hers. Secondly, I think Carol has been with the Bureau for almost four decades, has seen up close and personal how much more difficult it is for female agents, who only make up less than a quarter of the FBI special agents, while they make up an overwhelming majority of the administrative agents. It's still a much male-dominated world. And I think Carol understands the heart Atlee Pine has worked to get where she is, and that also gives the women another bond. Maybe, you know, way back when, Carol might have wanted to be a special agent as well, but maybe that opportunity wasn't there for her, so she might be living a little bit vicariously through Atlee.
It seems like anytime somebody goes back home, they discover that there were all sorts of secrets. We all think we know our hometown so well, and then we discover that we don't. It seems like that in literature and in real life. This had a hint of the Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil in the Georgia area, where that was set down in Georgia. Is that sort of something that was in your mind as you revealed these secrets throughout all of Atlee Pine's growing up that she didn't even know?
Absolutely. I mean, just because the place is small doesn't mean it's not complicated. If you look at Jane Marple, you know, Agatha Christie's old woman detective, she lived in St. Mary Mead, a very small village in England, and through just observing the people there, she knew everyone who ever lived in the entire world, at least all the different types of complexities that human beings have, the good and the bad. I think that places like that just, you know, have naturally, it's almost like there aren't enough people there to like dilute everything, so people there, you know, have more time to focus on each other, and people there maybe just have more interesting backgrounds in some ways, and maybe they've lived there their whole lives, and generations of people have passed through, and families are complicated, families are dysfunctional at many levels, and after a while things, you know, do start to accumulate, and certainly this town, in my mind, and this novel has a lot that it was trying to hide.
And Atlee, she's not a cold case investigator, but she's essentially investigating a cold case here. Do you think she's the only one that could actually investigate this case at this point and get anybody to talk?
You know, I think she's the one who has the best shot. She certainly has the motivation. I mean, her whole career and maybe her sanity is relying on her figuring this out finally. I don't think anybody, a cold case team coming in, would have near the motivation that she does. And she has the skills to get this done. She has a personal connection to some of the people. She has snatches of memory that would help her that other investigators may not have. And But I do think it's important that she's there with Carol, who's really her sounding board, and it helps her. And also there are some other people there, a local GBI agent, and then an FBI agent from her past comes down to help her as well. And I wanted to make sure that, you know, this was sort of a team effort, too. I didn't want Atlee to have to do this on her own. I thought that would have been stretching, you know, credibility and plausibility a little bit. This is a really complicated case and difficult to get your arms around, and for her to be able to do it in her mental state when everything was riding on it, she was so personally connected. I just thought maybe that was too much to ask of a person. So there were other people involved that had more objectivity, that could look at things from a little bit of a distance, and I think she needed that.
One thing I kept waiting to happen in the book, and I waited a long time, there wasn't a lot of conflict between the law enforcement jurisdictions here. Is that normal with the FBI coming in? Because it seems like there's always territorial fights.
Yeah, well, I'm not saying there's not, and there certainly are. And this one, and I could have played that up, but I, you know, for me, it wasn't nearly as important as having all of the people focus on the mystery and trying to figure out what had happened, because that was complicated enough without putting in sort of jurisdictional battles and contests over the people. I will say that, you know, people in rural jurisdictions where, look, they just don't have the same resources that you would have in New York City or Washington, D.C., they're just not there. And I felt like the GBI agent, and, you know, Andersonville didn't even have its own police force. It's a county sheriff's system there. I thought that the GBI agent on this is a guy who's a good guy, and he just wants to solve things. And I think he made the smart decision that I've got these resources that are freed. I didn't even have to call in that are staring me in the face. I would be an idiot not to take advantage of that, and he did. But, you know, there are some other books where I've had those jurisdictional confrontations because they've made sense. In this one, I just really thought it would muddy up the waters a little bit too much and make a situation that was already complicated, maybe too complicated.
I'm chatting with David Baldacci about his brand new Atlee Pine thriller, A Minute to Midnight. The book's available now wherever your fine books are sold. There's a lot of Civil War history in this book, and I felt like I was taking a trip down to the old battlefields as I read it. Are you a Civil War buff?
Well, you know, I grew up in Richmond, Virginia. How could I not be? Because you can't turn around and throw a rock in any direction in Virginia without hitting a Civil War battle site or monument. It's just all there. And my grandmother, when she lived with us for the last 10 years of her life, and when she passed away, she left me really the only thing she had at the time, which is an 1861 U.S. Springfield single-shot carbine rifle that my many times great uncle Paul Rose had carried in the Civil War, as my grandmother told me. She said the only problem was he fought for the Union. And I sort of cheekily, I was just a little boy, pointed out, you know, Grandma, didn't they win? I'm not sure she liked that too much. So I have been, I'm a history buff in general, and certainly the Civil War and the state that I grew up in was very important education-wise for lots of reasons, and I do know a lot about it. Any Civil War question that comes on, like Jeopardy, there was one last night, actually, where what general and his brother, you know, were a famous general in the Civil War and also a U.S. senator, and none of the people in Final Jeopardy got it right. And I, as soon as Alex said the question, I told my wife, Sherman, you know, the Sherman brothers, you know, William Tecumseh Sherman, who, you know, was the one who burned Atlanta, and his brother was a senator, and that's where we got the Sherman Antitrust Act. So.
Well, you were Mr. Colleague. You should have been on Jeopardy last night. But there's also a lot about cars in this book, and I learned more about luxury automobiles than I've ever thought was possible to know from reading one of your books. Is that another passion of yours?
We have a place in Amelia Island, Florida, where we go to in the winter, and every year they have one of the largest car shows in the world there, where, you know, people come in and they auction off these fabulous cars. And I've seen more cars, I think, in the last 3 years than I thought I've ever seen in my whole life. Every type, everything from clunkers to, you know, these ancient cars, even before the Model T, they were now just hunks of metal that you'd had to pay $100,000 to buy, just a piece of junk, and then spend $1 million refurbishing it, and people do, I guess. So that was something that I was interested in, and it fit into the plot in a couple of different ways, and I thought, why not? And, you know, it went this Pagani, but most people have heard of Lamborghinis and Ferraris and Bugattis, but I don't think many people have heard about a Pagani. Again, an Italian made, and I'm an Italian American, so I thought it'd be kind of cool to put that in there and, you know, let it figure into the plot along with some of the other cars as well.
Well, I'd never heard of a Pagani, so that was news to me. I had to Google it.
I had not heard of it until I went to the festival. trouble.
The other thing that you've been doing lately, you did one of those master classes online and to teach thriller writing, and I watched those episodes. And when I talk to authors, it seems like it's hard for some authors to describe their craft. They just do what they do, and they don't think about it outside the box. Was that a challenge for you to try to put together your process to actually try to teach other people?
Yeah, no, I did have to put a lot of work into that, actually, to sort of, you know, it's almost like you know that 2 + 2 = 4, and you accept that, but you're not really sure how to explain why it is. And for me, so when I was preparing for the master class, I decided, okay, you know, let me just set this up logically so that, you know, I can't tell them instinctively everything I think about when I'm trying to put a story together, but I can tell them sort of the nuts and bolts of how I approach it. So I focused on how I do my research and how that research ends up in the book or not, and how I put, you know, use many outlines, MINI outlines throughout the course of the book, how I sort of let the characters evolve and grow organically. I don't follow from an outline from A to Z. I let the ending sort of naturally get there for me at the same time while I'm writing the novel. And, you know, I tried to give them sort of, you know, my approach of how I set up my battle plan. And so I was able to put that together, but it wasn't like I just all of a sudden just sat down in front of the camera and, okay, here, you know, off we go. There was some thought that put into it. I was trying to make it logical and cohesive and sort of linear so that I could show them how I went about my task. And I also wanted to explain to them that, you know, some writing classes don't even focus. If once you're published, then there's the business of publishing and writing. And I wanted to let them know that their career is their career, and no one else will care about it more than they do. And don't abdicate control over that, because only bad things will probably happen, and you only have yourself to blame. So make sure that you understand the publishing world and the business end of it and are involved in it. And you can have people who that's their job, and they can help you, but don't abdicate control of that.
All right. The book is A Minute to Midnight. It's the latest Atlee Pine thriller. It's available now wherever your books are sold. The author is David Baldacci. David, thanks for joining us once again.
Thank you very much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakulskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.